My name's David. I'm an alcoholic. You know, I enjoy the saying she, you know, went to Georgia Tech. You can really tell any story you want when you come up here. You could actually hear the one I'm going to tell. So anyway, you know, I'm out of town. Nobody knows me. I'm an alcoholic. And that was huge for me to figure out. I had a diagnosis, man. I mean, just an absolute diagnosis. My whole life, I didn't know what was the matter with me. I mean, I really did. My mother would be like, "What is the matter with you?" And I was stumped. You know, I had no idea. I thought it was the family I was in. I thought it was the parents, my parents, the car my parents drove, the neighborhood we lived in. You know, the school I went to, the friends all down the street. That's why I was like so sad. You know, couldn't get my mind off my own self. Suffered horribly about from that for years. So an alcoholic, what does that mean? So now, after working 12 steps, 99% of the time I'm comfortable. And I was never comfortable. Never ever comfortable. The book talks about restless, irritable, and discontent. So what does that mean? Like, I'm an uneducated man. I think I went from the little training I could to the big book. So there was nothing in between. I was a recess guy. I'm all recess. So, like, what does that mean? So, like, okay, so I'm restless. What does that mean? So I can't sit still. My mind won't quit racing. I'm nervous. I make coffee nervous. You know? I mean, I'm just a real fast guy, you know? Restless, you know? In the middle of a haircut, I heard, "I gotta go, man." You know? So I walk around with a half a hairdo. You know? So, you know, irritable. If you look up irritable in the dictionary, it means sensitive. I'm sensitive. I'm super thin skinned. I get crushed by a piece of mail. The phone rings. I'm actually crushed. You know, I think I'm not going to get my way. I'm crushed. You know, so I mean, this is how this stuff affects me. Super duper sensitive. And then discontent. I'm discontent. What's that mean? You look that up, that's dissatisfied. And that's who I am. I'm absolutely dissatisfied. I'm dissatisfied with everything. I'm dissatisfied with all of you. And I'm absolutely dissatisfied with myself. That's how I roll. And what happens is 4 or 5 drinks take that all away. All of a sudden my pockets got deep. I'm driving a nice car. You know, the girls that, you know, didn't look that good are not looking very good. And, you know, but you see, what happened to me is that I couldn't stop at number 4 and drink water for the next hour. I couldn't switch to Diet Coke after I started, you know, 4 or 5 drinks in the shop. I couldn't take an hour break and drink Diet Coke and then go back and, you know, drink 1 or 2 more and then go home. I had to have number 5. I had to have number 6. You know, and it just kept going. So, and now, the only way that I quit drinking was that I had to work the first 7 steps. That's the only way I could stop drinking, was that I had to do that. And I did that without a sponsor, and I did that in the first 90 days of sobriety. So let's back it up. These are when I talk kind of funny, these are from New Orleans, and they have unlimited drinking there. My father's in the military, and he's a raging guy. And my mother complains a lot and worries a lot. And nothing's going to work out, and everything's negative. My father's a workaholic. At one time, he was a state of Louisiana employee of the year. And we'd have dinner, and she would complain so much that he would get up and like go punch 20 holes in the sheetrock, and he just wanted to shut her up, you know. So that's when I was in, and then she would always complain about what we did, you know, how we was in trouble, you know, and so he'd knock my lights out at the dinner table, you know, and I had two older sisters and a younger sister, and, you know, that's kind of it, but that's all I knew. So then we, you know, and so we went on vacation, and we go to vacation on the beach. We always, like, visited this, military base. So, you know, we go to the military base, and I start picking on my little sister. You know, I start picking on and picking on, and I make her cry. You know, I tease her. You know, passing on was given to me. And then so I split from the store. I mean, split from, you know, where she's at. And 10 minutes go by, and, you know, I don't see him, so I go looking for him, and then I go look out the door, and he comes with my daddy across the grass. He got a fire on a cigarette about this long, got his fist clenched, comes up to me, grabs me, shakes me until my lights went out, takes me by the hand, drags me all the way across the parade ground, throws me in the back of the car, and we take off, and Andy's pulled us over. And so they asked me to get out, asked if I was okay. It was like, yeah, you know, I'm in Savage all the time. I didn't tell him that, but yeah, I'm okay. And then so, you know, I don't know what the guy was telling my dad and whatever kind of conversation they had, but I remember getting back in that car, and I remember hating my mother for what she was doing to my dad. I hated my dad for what he was doing to us, and I hated God for putting me in that family. Straight up. I think I was in sixth grade, somewhere after sixth grade. Seventh grade came along, and only hung out with the super cool guy. I was walking down the street with the coolest guy in seventh grade. I was second coolest, and he asked me if I smoked weed, and I knew how to answer the question. So we ended up smoking, and I went and got an 8-pack of Miller Ponies, and they were absolutely horrible. I probably drank 1.5 of them because he made me. I mean, I was used to drinking milk, but you know, can't I just put a hair in it? Anyway, so, I mean, whatever, nothing happened, you know, I just went and did that, and that's the people that I hung around with, you know, and so, next thing you know, people start calling me up, you know, I ended up buying a bag of weed, it was $5 for half a bag of weed back then, and, you know, people started calling me up, you know, I guess they wanted to smoke or whatever, and then so I had a running crew, and I really didn't have any friends before that, because, like, if you didn't want to play my game, I'd beat you up, you know, so your personal relationships don't do well, you know, like that. Okay, so, you know, fast forward, I always felt on the outside. I mean, there's one thing that I could tell you that I had is that I was absolutely separated from everybody else. I was just completely different from everybody I knew, just absolutely different. And so, and I would do these things to, like, try to fit in. So we'd sit around, and what they'd do is they'd tell stories when we'd drink quartz in the woods about the crazy things other people did. So I would do crazy things hoping that they would tell stories about me, which they did, but never in front of me. I didn't feel any of them accolades. But one of the things that I did was, like, you know, they said steal your parents' car and go driving around, you know. So I stole my parents' car and went driving around, and I got caught, and they brought me home. I was begging the cops not to bring me home, but they did anyway. He woke him up. It was like midnight. He said, I'll take care of him. And then when I came in the house, he grabbed me by the throat, slammed me up against the wall, and he was going to lay into me. And I had just smoked a joint, and I looked at him right now, and I said, it's not going to happen. And I was looking at him right in the eyeball, and he never hit me, and he let me go, and he ain't hit me since. But I tell you what, he surely did want to. So, you know, that was like a freshman in high school, you know, and I ended up getting kicked out of that high school. And what happened was I was riding around, so, like, I'm drinking for about 3 years, I guess, you know, 3 to 4 years. All of a sudden, I'm sitting back in this car with this cord in between my legs, and all of a sudden, man, I'm the most comfortable guy. I'm as comfortable as I've ever been in my life. I had never experienced this before. I mean, I am absolutely lit, just sitting in the most comfortable, you know. And then so he's like, I got to have my car home at midnight, so I freak out, we get in a fight, and I go back and steal my parents' car, and then we end up hitting the house, But you know, so and it's like, and it, so I'm running home, you know, telling my friend he's got a broken heart. Somebody stole the car, right? Somebody stole the car. You know, I'm full of blood, got glass in my face, and that was me. I'm not gonna cop to anything. It wasn't me. I wasn't there. I don't know what you're talking about. That's just how I roll, all the way to the electric chair. You know, so. You know, I ended up going to college, and you know, and so what, you know, I ended up going to spring break, and I just absolutely loved it, you know, and you know, it was like the pipe yard kind of fell out, so I'm in spring break. You know, good girls are really good looking, they all going to college, so I'm available to go to college. I had been kicked out of high school 2 years ago, so I went to, you know, sign up for GED, went to college. I'm a black guy drinking, you know, this is happening all the time. So, you know, I go in and I'm getting in trouble one time, you know, and then I ended up, you know, having a girlfriend or something like that. One time we went to this concert and she didn't go, you know, it's one thing I didn't do, man. She was like always, like, you know, like I didn't want to party with her, you know. But I mean, I needed a girlfriend, but she had money. Anyway, so, you know, I'm like, I went to this concert, so I ended up calling, I was so hammered, somebody turned me on the Jägermeister or something like that, and I remember I was swinging on this phone like a pendulum, you know, the old pay phones, you know, and a cop actually came up and said over the speaker, hey, you on the phone, I know you ain't gonna drive, whoever you talking to, you better tell them to come and get you, because you ain't driving tonight. And, you know, I was like, you hear that? You know, she was mad. She wasn't coming. So anyway, I went and passed out and, you know, woke up and drove probably like 20 minutes later. You know, and I was so drunk and so tired. I couldn't stay awake. And because I was going to the 60 miles away, it was like all bridge. And then so I'm driving, I'm just falling awake. I'm in the hot rod going over 100 miles an hour and I wake up and I'm right in the back of somebody. And so I end up yanking the wheel to the left and yanking it back and staying, and I'm missing by a millimeter, man. I mean, it was so close. And then I ended up, you know, I think I let a little bit of pee out. But I made it to school, and, you know, the next morning I woke up, man, and I said, that is it, man. That is it. I am absolutely quitting. I am never, ever going to drive again. It is over. You know? I was 20 years old. I was 20 years old. I walked to school that whole week, you know. We ended up breaking up, you know, me and that girl, and then I ended up seeing her on a concert, I don't know, about a year later, something like that, and then so I started guzzling, and what happened, like, I almost, like, T-boned the DWI band in the French Quarter, and then so it was like, you know, I went to jail, and I woke up the next morning, they ended up letting me out, my sister called the drug judge, I had one of them sisters, and I know which one to call. And you know, I called up one of my boys. I'm like, what happened last night? He said, oh, bro, you was funny. You was out in the middle of the street with the breathalyzer telling the cop you wasn't getting no smoke. So, you know, it was all fun and games, you know, for a while. That's some funny stories here, but, you know, so... What happened after that was, I wanted to quit drinking. I actually saw the movie Clean and Sober, and I think that really, that 12-stepped me, you know. So what I decided to do is one of 100 times, is that first of all, for a long time, 5 or 6 years, I tried to control my drinking. I just wanted to prevent the blackout. You know, I just don't want to blackout. You know, I want to drink, but I just don't want to black out, you know. Can I please just go home after 15 drinks? You know, can I please just go home after 10 drinks, you know? I didn't drink every day, you know. It was always, you know, I was like a binger. So then when that didn't work, then I said, well, I got to quit. I knew I had to quit, but I just absolutely could not stop, man. No matter what I did or what I tried, the craziest thing I had ever done in my life, I did Stone Cold Sober, and that was pick up the first drink. That's the craziest thing I had ever done. Absolutely. So anyway, so I try to quit. I'm like 5 days sober. I'm bartending because, you know, oh, if I was a bartender, then you know how my boys would be in there. And, you know, I could just be cool and be with them and have some fun and just drink one or two or something like that. I just figured I wouldn't get kicked out of the bar if I was working there. But anyway, it didn't work out. And so I ended up, you know, waking up the next morning and telling this girl, I can't live like this no more. Bring me to the rehab, you know. So I ended up going to the rehab. The woman called my dad over there in the bed. Like, you want to stay here? And I said, yeah, because you always want to do everything the easy way. You know, so I ended up doing like 28 days of treatment, you know. And like, I tried to get out of there in the beginning. But then, you know, after I went to my, you know, I was like, I decided to stay. And when I got out, you know, it was just like, man, I saw what I was living in. I was just overwhelmed and just, I suffered horribly from like tidal waves of resentment and self-pity. Tidal waves of resentment and self-pity. And, you know, it was just hit me and I looked at this and it was just, there's no way I could clean it up. And I was just like, you know, I guess I can throw my weed away now since my life is over. And, well, that ain't gonna happen, you know. And I remember smoking weed, dude, and just laying on my bed. It was the most guiltiest I felt in my whole life, you know, 28 days in that bed, my daddy's big check he just spent. But I thought everybody that I rode the bus with and all the people in the meeting that saw me was counting my days. So I kind of went to AA, but I put nobody near me. You know, don't come near me. Some bald-headed man comes smiling at me. You know what I mean? It was, I really thought they were pedophiles, you know? So, you know, it was like, I mean, everybody was like, you better, you know, and they were cornering me And I just, you know, so anyway, I just kind of, you know, kind of came late and left early. And I was just like, you know, I'd hear a couple things. Well, I'll try that, you know, after I had a slip, you know. And then I'd be like, okay, well, I'll try that. You know, I was hanging out with my boys, you know. Sometimes I'd hang out with them. One time I hung out with them until like 2 o'clock in the morning. And then all of a sudden the thought crossed my mind, well, they drink, ain't nothing, man. They drink, ain't nothing going to happen to them. Why can't I just, you know, and if the book talks about that, we see them drinking with impunity. You know, so why can't I? You know, even after this long, long history, that's the insanity of the first drink. You know, so next thing you know, it's up again till noon the next day. So, finally what happens is that my grandmother died, and I went to her wake, and it was on a Thursday. And then so I went to the bar. Anytime anything came up for me, I went to the ballroom, because that's where my boys were. And that's just where I felt comfortable. I didn't feel comfortable. I enjoyed AA meetings, but I didn't want none of them near me. I went to go see my peeps, and so I seen this dude who ain't seen me in over a year. You know, I was like, hey, man, you want to take a ride over the river? Sure. You know, so we ride over there. So he goes in like the little general, picks up two long necks, and goes, puts them on the counter, and I start telling myself, I ain't going to drink. I ain't going to drink. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. He comes to my door and he sits in the console. I'm not going to drink. I'm not going to drink. Or I'll just take one sip, you know. And then I take one sip. And then I go to the bar and I said, I'm drinking one and that's it. You know, I tried all my might to drink one and I said, screw it. And then the next morning I ended up waking up with a girl that I hated. So what happened was that with a 28-day treatment program and 100 AA meetings, something happened to me. I mean, that was like, that happened to me 50 times before, you know. It's just, that's what I do. And it just numbed me out, man. And I just felt like my life was over. My drinking life was over. I just absolutely lost. I lost. I mean, I'm a complete failure. You know, and I was going to another school. They had a delete and repeat program this time in South Louisiana. And, you know, went to school. And on Sunday night, I walked to a meeting in the rain. And I remember sitting down, there was a podium call up. I had never been there before, a couple of cafeteria tables. And the dude that was talking from the lectern said, is anybody coming back from the drunk? And I just stood up. I would never stand up in AA meeting. And I just stood up, you know, so I went up there to get a chip, and then the dude wanted me to talk, you know, I'm like, I'm good. And so anyway, so I ended up sharing. It was the first time in my life I told the truth. It was the first time in my life I told him about all the drinks I had, all the weed I smoked, how I went through treatment. And I went and sat down. Something had changed in me. It was given to me. That level of desperation was given to me. And I went and sat down, and I felt like everybody was looking at me like, you're a scumbag, and you ain't never getting sober. And I asked this dude next to me, and you know, you ask the guy next to you what he's going to say. He said, how do you stay sober? And then the guy's like, you work the steps. And so I looked at number one, and I said, yeah, that's me. That's my diagnosis, you know? I looked at number two, I said, that's what I got to do. I got to start praying. And then so I prayed. I prayed that night. I went home and I asked God to keep me sober from all, everything. You know, please, God can help me. I can't do this. And it was my first surrender. And that was April 23rd, 1989. That's my sobriety date, my first surrender. And I prayed that prayer for 30 days. And then at 60 days or 30 days, I was like, God, my prayer changed. You've got to take these feelings away. You have got to take these feelings away. I am dying. I mean, tidal waves of self-pity, tidal waves of emptiness, loneliness to the 10th degree. I mean, just loss of control. I mean, just absolutely insanity. I couldn't stop my brain. I needed some help, and there was nobody could help me. I was clearly beyond human aid, and for some reason, I intuitively knew that, and so I was begging God, and I would get these answers, and the answers would be like, the first one I got was like, go to a meeting, and I'd be, oh, it's a miracle, he's talking to me. You know, so I end up walking to a meeting, you know, it's like, man, well, I can't believe you guys talking to me, man, this is the most miraculous thing ever, you know. And then so I do that, and then, you know, another month later, I'm still praying that prayer. I mean, I am dying. And I could have passed a lot of tests and I don't have a problem with alcohol and drugs. Because at that time, I didn't. I was stone cold sober. And, you know, and one time when I was begging him, please take these films away. He's like, you need to do an inventory. And so I got up, and I'll tell you where I was at. I was a year salary in debt. You know, I don't even know if I had a job. I had a cafeteria table, a chair, a mattress on the floor, iron skillet so I can put it in the oven and on top of the stove, one pair of shoes, and a higher power. Hey, people that wanted to kill me. I mean, really, they were looking to kill me. And, you know, so I had nothing, man. I ain't had nothing but a higher power. And they said, do an inventory. And I sat down that book and I read it. And it was just like, you write down your resentments. And I did the top dozen. And I looked at it, what they did. And I wrote down why I hated them all. And then I read it and said, well, what was affecting you? You know, and then I noticed that everything that they did was affected my self-esteem. And I was like, is that why I hate them so much? Because they affected my self-esteem? Oh, that's ridiculous. You know? And so for some reason, it just made it a lot smaller. And then I went and read those next four, five, six paragraphs. And then what it said to me at that time was like, now you make a list of what you did to them. And then so I wrote down my mom. So I wrote down, I stole a car. You know, I stole money out of purse. I cursed her. Got kicked out of college. Got kicked out of grammar school, got kicked out of high school, slept in the front yard, got brought home by the police, had to bail from out of jail. I don't even know if she slept in the last 10 years. You know, and just on and on. And then my dad, right, all of this, you know, about my dad, my girlfriend, you know, fooled around on her 38 times, stole money out of her purse, you know, and just, you know, went down. And then when I was finished that, and you know, I don't know if it was because that I asked God, I was willing to do absolutely anything. I mean, anything that he wanted me to do. I don't know if it was just that earnest prayer or desire to get well, or it was because I sat down and did that inventory. But that's what I was told. That's what I did. I mean, that's what I was told from deep down inside, man. Deep down within is where I found this relationship at. And I looked at it and something happened to me. It was the same experience almost that I had that day I woke up that weekend. When I got sober, and it just absolutely changed me, you know, and I looked at, you know, how I shot down other people, how I talked to them, I always one-upped everybody, that's what we get, that's the family that I grew up in, you know, we always one-upped each other, nothing was going to work out, and everything like that, and so I started to change, you know, and so when I was hanging with people, and they talked to me like that, I was like, wow, man, I used to talk to people just like that, And then I could say a prayer if it was getting rattled, you know. And then if I could go on a job interview, you know, I could say a prayer. I could bring my higher power in there with me. Or like when I was in a Walmart line, I wanted to kill everybody in front of me. You know, I could say the serenity prayer, you know, and actually be able to be patient and wait as the fourth person in line. You know, so I noticed that, you know, that bringing a higher power through my higher life actually worked. One thing led to another. You know, I asked a couple of guys as sponsors and ended up graduating from college. And it was funny what I did, what you do when you're crazy like that. But I ended up, I achieved 76 hours in 2 years while I worked full-time and I dean's listed. And I was involved in AA. It's funny when you did that, 4 years prior to it, I couldn't even get 6 hours. And no job. So anyway, so it's funny what you can do, but I ended up grabbing, when you can't sleep, you know, you're kind of available. But, so, you know, I moved back to New Orleans, and, you know, I'm trying to get it going on, trying to get things working, and I'm bartending and working full time. Somebody asked me back, and I told the bartender, I just said, you know something, man, it depends on how I feel. I'll give you one shift if I can pull it off, but if it ain't, I'm leaving. He's like, yeah, give it a whirl, you know, and next thing you know, it's like 3 or 5 in the morning, and then it ain't even crossed my mind. So at 6 months sober, I was doing better than I had ever did in my previous life. And it was those 7 steps that I worked in my first 90 days that actually got and kept me sober, I'm convinced. And I did it with all earnestness. So that's what I believe. That's my story. That's what I have to say. So, you know, I did that. Then I was a free man, you know, kind of. So I stayed in AA. So, you know, it's early sobriety and stuff like that. And so, you know, my insurance for 3 DUIs is going to be like $4,000 a year. So it was like, well, you know, I can pull that off working these 2 full-time jobs. I got a new call coming in the morning. And then, I decided to quit on Friday night. You know, the dude comes back and catches me giving a glass of water away and throws my juice bottles out on the dance floor. And so I'm just like, I'm out of here. So I quit. And I got this new call coming in the morning. I tell him to call it off. So I go buy another car, like $8,000 cash. It was in 89, 90. And I hit for 3 days and got stolen. So my bank account's gone. Then they got a shootout outside my house. Then I'm going into the hospital and I get armed robbed. So all within a 90-day period, so I became available to move. So then I met this, I was kind of involved with young people a little bit. I asked this dude what he was doing. He said he just, you know, he was sober, and he said he just got accepted to a master's program in Boulder. I was like, where's that? He said, Colorado. I said, I've been, you know, thinking about moving. You need a roommate. He said, yeah, so that was it. July 4th, 92, and that's when I met Rob's 2 brothers. That same weekend, they moved up here together. So I'm there, you know, and I'm cool. I think I'm in AA, you know. I mean, I'm a man. They don't really recognize it yet, but, you know, I'm the man. I'm sober. I'm the bully. You know, I start hitting all the meetings and everything like that. And they're really good, man. I mean, these guys are talking a little bit different. They talk heavy on the steps and blah, blah, blah. 8:40 is when I stop. Okay. So, you know, so I'm up there and, I start getting scared again. I mean, real scared, man. I mean, the phone rings. I start getting scared. I'm having financial difficulty. Some self-pity starts creeping back in. I didn't have a sponsor. You know, just really, really scared about my future. Don't know how I'm going to pull this off. You know, and stuff like that. I'm kind of doing AA. And, you know, and finally I meet this dude, and I see him at a lot of AA meetings, and he comes and asks me, you know, how I'm doing. And so I decided to be honest with him. I said, well, I think I'm having some financial difficulty. And he said, hey, you can clear your financial amends. And I said, no. And he said, well, how do you expect to have a spiritual relationship with money if you haven't completed your financial amends? I'm like, what a dick. And, you know, so anyway, I'm still befriending with him, but he asked me if he brings me to his home group, you know, a couple weeks later, and we go to his home group, sit down the Thursday night, and, you know, I sit in there, and I hear things that really, you don't hear much of AA at all. You know, all these people completed amends and all of this stuff. And where I was at in my life, I mean, I felt like that I was just scared to death of my future, you know. And I seen this guy come up, man, and they called on him to speak. And he was, like, full of tattoos. And he had grown up in an orphanage. And, you know, he was in a motorcycle gang. And, you know, did armed robbery. And he was really the calmest dude in the meeting. So I was just like, man, this guy, I mean, he is doing well. And he definitely came from a worse place than me. So I could never ask anybody to be my sponsor. So I went and got his name on the list. From the phone list, and I called him up the next day, man, and I just said, hey, you know, I've been, I think I need some help. And he goes, okay, well, let's meet an hour before the meeting. So I went down there and met with him, and he's like, bring the big book. So I brought the big book, and he opened up, and he said, okay, well, let's find out if you're an alcoholic. And I'm like, what? I mean, so it's like threatening my whole existence, you know? I don't even know. I don't even think I heard anything he said after that, you know? So, but anyway, we started. What he wanted me to do is go deep down within myself and see if I can identify with some of the things in the book. You know, can I relate to how Bill's thinking was, whatever. And so my first step completely changed. He asked me if I was an alcoholic. When I came in, it was like, yeah, because I could guzzle a half a bottle of vodka. But that wasn't the reason why I was an alcoholic. The reason why I was an alcoholic is I couldn't take four drinks after being sober 3 days. I couldn't take four drinks and take a break for an hour and a half. You know, that's why I couldn't do it. It was the comfort that it gave me and the inability to stay away from the first drink, you know. So my whole first step changed, you know. And then he told me I needed this much willingness to believe in a higher power. It was just a molecule of it. You had that much willingness? I'm like, yeah, you know. And I'm like, you know, so I'm buying into this, like, all, and I'm willing to do it one step at a time. At that time, I can't tell you how scared I was to do this. I mean, I just really can't tell you how scared I was to do this, all of this. And then so when I did step three, I mean, both of us went down there, and I meant it 1,000% that I was willing to do that. I was absolutely willing to play in the Salvation Army band. You know, I was absolutely willing to give out pamphlets on the corner if that's what he wanted me to do. That's where the willingness was. So, and then after that, he showed me how to do an inventory. And so I ended up writing all these, you know, I had like 100 items I did. And we went in and we fifth stepped, you know, and like I had some dark crannies, you know, and I was scared to death. And, you know, so I had to tell him first. I felt like I was in sixth grade and was going to have to fight the baddest eighth grade after school, you know, and I went in there, so I had to lay it on him first. And he was like, gee, man, you got somebody to talk to that about? And I was like, man, that's the first time that came out of my mouth, you know. And so we talked about it and stuff like that. And he was the most gentlest dude. He was just absolutely perfect for me, you know. And man, I just started crying on the way home. Like, why is this guy listening to me and listening to all this? You know, that long inventory is good. It's like a broken record, you know. And, you know, anyway, I did it, you know, and I ended up doing 6 and 7 on my mic. And then, you know, they wanted me to do amends, you know, so I wrote them down on paper, all of these amends that I did. And I mean, the amends that, I wrote down and I thought I had, and he helped me with them, you know, and stuff like that. One thing I like to, like, just so every time you go through your inventory, you can find something out about yourself. I remember doing the sex inventory. I mean, I'm trying all my might. I want to figure out everything that's the matter with me. You understand? I mean, I'm going deep, deep, deep. And you're a much more effective writer after you went down to look at that first step way, way back, deep down inside. And so, you know, I'm trying to write all of this stuff down. And I remember just this one thing hit me. It was just like, you know, when I did my old girlfriend, whatever, I said, when have you been inconsiderate? And then so I go to write down, and I was like, geez, where have I been considerate? You know? And up until that time, I had never, ever considered anybody in my life. Never. The thought had never, ever crossed my mind to consider somebody else. Never. Buckshot. And that was probably the biggest thing I got out of my inventory that year, besides being dominated by other people, you know, and how I needed a higher power to get through life. So So the men, you know, I bring them and stuff like that. We go through them and stuff, and he tells me kind of say it. And that's how they. Then that's how I learned about a payment plan and, you know, and everything. And I stole a bunch of stuff, and they just like, well, you know, when I hit a big, I just cut them a check, you know. But if that had not happened at that time, and so like. You know, okay, so I write down these 25 cards or whatever that I'm going to do, and I'm flying back to New Orleans to do them, and I go back, and it's like on a Saturday, I think it is, you know, and it's Wednesday, and I haven't done one. Every time I look at these cards, I get a panic attack, and I ask my higher powers, what are you doing, you know, why can't I do this? I did it. I surrendered all my mind and theory. I did everything on 7. You can have all my defects and everything. Why can't I do this stuff? Why am I doing this? Why am I so paralyzed with fear to do this? And I ended up going to a meeting on Wednesday night, and I was talking to somebody who actually knows this couple, and what they do in New Orleans, they go out to dinner 7 days a week. And so they asked me after the meeting, they don't have a lot of experience with making amends at this particular meeting, and they said, you want to go to dinner? So I was like, fine, so we went to dinner. So, you know, we went there and everything, I'm having a good time, and all of a sudden I realized at the end of dinner that the restaurant that we were sitting in was one of my cards, you know, it was one of my cards. And then when I realized that, I had no other choice. I said, hey guys, you know something? I'm going to get up and do an amends. And I just stood up. I think they rang. And I went and cornered the manager, and I told him who I was and what I was doing and what I had stolen from him. And then I wanted to pay him back and stuff like that. The dude was real standoffish. I am intimidated. And, you know, and the guy just, I mean, whatever, but when I walked back out there in the smoking hole, Shonda and Reed was there, and when I, you know, went back out to the smoking hole, I was lit, man, I mean, I was lit. The next morning, I got up, you know, my mom was sitting in the living room, I opened up, I had a whole book, I had 20 of them, 20 things, you know, and I told her I wanted to read something to it, you know, and she kind of went up in a chair like this, because they, like, my sisters went through some therapy thing when I went through rehab and did this confrontation, and she thought that another one of them was coming, and, you know, I rattled up, you know, it's just like, yeah, so, you know, I'm there's a lot of things that I've done, you know, to you, that's been bothering me for a long time, and it's important that I try to clean these up, you know, and the thing is important that I read this to you, okay? So, you know, I'm sorry for stealing your car and stealing money out of your purse. And the first time she said that, I was like, I'm 15, and you know, I'm sorry for stealing the silver fork. So you didn't do that, Susan did. He's like, no, that was me. And, you know, and just on and on. And then I lifted my head up after I was about two-thirds finished. And it was the calmest I had ever seen in my life. Just sitting there looking at me, as calm as I've ever seen. And I ended up finishing them. And she's like, you know, the people that, it's funny how that honesty brings honesty. She said, you know, people that grow up in an alcoholic home, that's what they go, that's what they experience. And we're just real proud of it. You know, I tried to make amends to my dad, and he's just like, don't you get sentimental on me, you know? And, I mean, he was serious, and what was he thinking, you know, when I asked him, I thought, when you checked me into rehab, he goes, I thought that was just another way you get my money. And, you know, and I ended up, so basically, I went to Catholic school, and I was from this parish. And everybody, all the Catholic kids went to Catholic school, and they had a fair there every year. They had Oyster Poor Boys. I like Oyster Poor Boys. And, you know, and that's where all the kids went. I did 8th grade there, and 7th twice, actually. And so I had this teacher, you know, and, I mean, I hated it. She had it out for me. She gave me 100 detentions. And I ended up, as a matter of fact, the one across the hall hated me worse and failed me. And so I had the seventh grade again. Well, that teacher didn't want me, so I had this one again. So I got another 100 detentions. And then I went to the eighth grade, and then they moved up to the eighth grade, and I had again. So I couldn't shake it. And I mean, I gave it a hell. For 3 years, I gave it a hell. Anyway, the last day of eighth grade, I wrote this letter, you know. Dear Miss Murphy, I hate your guts. You know? I really hope that you and your family die in a fire. And just, I mean, just everything. It was a whole page. And at that time, it wasn't written well. So anyway, so all we had to do was leave the eighth grade, go to the cafeteria for 15 minutes, and then get on the bus and go home. So on the way to the cafeteria, I slipped it in the top drawer. When got on the bus, and then as the bus was pulling away, the principal come running up and said, "Stop the bus." And so they stopped the bus, yanked me off of it, told them I needed to stay, told the bus driver they needed to stay, brought me back, undid this paper, and said, "Did you write this?" "No, ma'am, I never seen it." You know? I mean, that's how I roll. And, you know, one day somebody should be able to handle you. So that's how I left the eighth grade. She was on my list. So, see, I did my mom, then I had to do it. I knew where she lived. She lived in our neighborhood, kind of. And so I went and drove out of house. It was during the summer. And that's how you tell if you're willing to do it, man, is you hear that sound. But so I knocked on the door, you know, and she's like, "Who is it?" And it's like 15 years later or whatever, and I was just like, you know, I told her who I was. And there were some things that I did when I was a student that has been bothering me for a long time, and I was wondering if I could, you know, just try to clean that up some kind of way. And I guess you could tell by the tone of my voice, you know. First of all, I told her that, you know, who I was, and, you know, you hear the chain go on the door. And then, you know, and then, you know, after I rattled that off to her, she, like, undid the chain and opened up the door, and, you know, she wanted to, like, small talk for a little while with a couple of friends, but I was dead serious, you know, when I was there. And you know, she was like, "Hey, remember that time when everybody came back from recess and you lowered everybody's desk?" And I said, "Yeah." That wasn't on the call, though. And she said, "I'm so angry at you." And she's like, "Remember that time I put the chalk on the chalk rail and the whole rail fell down?" That wasn't on the card either. And I said, "Yeah, I remember that trip. I was just absolutely livid. I wanted to get out of this, out of the school." You know, it was the St. Avalanche. And so, you know, I don't remember that letter. But I can't believe that she's standing here doing this. I just absolutely can't believe it. As a matter of fact, I'm going to tell the principal that she came by. These people were still there. You know, I didn't even saw it. You get a job somewhere, you're going to stay there for a year. And, you know, so she said that. And let me tell you, man, when I turned around and walked down that drive, she goes, "If I wasn't so full of pain, I'd give you a hug right now." I'm like, you know, I gave her a hug. And I walked down that driveway, I was 1,000% in absolute freedom. 1,000%. I was levitated down that driveway. And that was it, man. I went and sat in this, you know, I called up my old boss and, you know, told him I was stealing from him. How much he wanted to kill me, you know? I told him how much, and he was just like, "Well, that's not much." I said, "No, Rob, this is very, very important that I pay you back." And he's like, "You know something, man? That's worth having an honest friend. That is absolutely worth having an honest friend. So I'll just look at you as that, you know, 5 minutes. So, six, actually. And, so we actually, you know, so that was like, you know, number two, whatever. But, I had worked in a mall, like the young girl here, and I had stole a lot of money. And I needed to call him, so I called him up on the phone. It was Nate answered him. He was in the phone book, old man, multi-million dollar business. And it was me. He's like, "He's not available right now." I said, "Man, it is very, very important that I speak with him. And she like paused for a minute. It was his maid. She goes, hold on. And so she went and got him. She went and got him. He's like, hello. And I told him, I said, you know who I was? And I said, I was an employee of yours. And when I worked for you, I stole a lot of money. And he said, you know, how much? And I told him, like, $5,000 or $6,000. Like, I think you want to. He said, well, you got that kind of money? I said, no, sir. He said, how do you expect to pay it back? And I said, well, I was thinking about a monthly thing. And he said, okay, how about $1,000 a year? You think you can pull that off? I'm like, absolutely. He said, all right, let me write down my address. So he wrote down the address. And it's like, I'm 80 years old. I ain't never got a phone call like this. You know, you should feel absolutely wonderful about what you're doing right now. I'm going to give all this money to charity. And just on and on like that. I was like, well, thank you very much. You know, and when I hung up that phone, it was just another one. Just tons of bricks fell off my back, just fell off my back. And you know, I ended up going to an education program after that. And I was out of work for like 3 or 4 months. But that, his last name is G-O-D. And I always had that money. Always had that money. It was always the first thing I paid, and I had that money, and I sent him that money for 5 years every month, 5+ years. I feel like I'm forgetting a couple of minutes I wanted to share, but so anyway, I went through that, and let me tell you, so now I can go back to that school, and I can have boys to four boys. You know, before, when I was living in that town, I couldn't go to my mall. At the end of my drinking, I couldn't even come out during the day, you know? I mean, I could only come out when the sun went down, you know, and go to the bar. So now I can go anywhere, you know, in my town. I mean, anywhere. Free man, that's what it talks about, free man. Step 10, you know, doing step 11, praying, God, please direct my thinking, please direct my thinking, please remove my self-pity, please remove my dishonesty, please remove my self-seeking motives. The dishonesty is all back. We talked about self-pity, I was dying from that, but the dishonesty, it's about all the rules that I broke, my rules that I broke when I was doing inventory. I continually broke my own rules. That's why I hated myself, continually. That's why I woke up and punched the pillow wondering why I was still alive. Because I continually broke my own rules over and over again. And it's a lot more easy to be average, you know. And I think that's what 10 and 11 is about. So there's my dishonesty. You need to remove that, because deep down inside, I don't want to be that person. I don't want to harm people. Please remove my selfishness. I got to get my mind off my own self. Please show me to be helpful and to be considerate of others. Let me find an interest in other people. I need a higher power to pull that off. You know? Self-pity. All of a sudden, you know, a month goes by and it hits me. I was a depressant. I really felt like I was a depressant. And after doing this for a month, I realized that I am depressed. And maybe I wasn't depressed. Maybe I had self-pity. Because every time that I felt depressed, I was thinking about my own self. You know? Something shifted in me. So that's something that God gave me, you know? He was able to remove my self-pity. What I do for step 12, you know, I take a meeting to the jail every Monday. That's where I go. That's where I can talk regularly. You know, and I belong to a home group, and it actually, we read literature, because I can't do any other kind of meeting. I need to have a topic out of the big book, because I have experience with recovery. You know, I know how to recover. So anyway, so one more thing, you know, about that, I want to tell you a story. So I'm up in Colorado. I got 1 minute left. You got the time? I go home. No, Katrina happens, you know. My dad's like, I ain't going away. Well, that's a big one coming. But, you know, I tell him, and, you know, so he don't answer the phone on Sunday. That's when the hurricane hit. And so evidently one of my sisters scooped him up and brought him to death. and you couldn't find him, whatever, the whole area code was out, but we ended up talking, and he lost pounds, and I mean, it was just horrible going through that whole situation. Everybody in my family lost a house with one, and they all lived together, which I don't know that the aftermath was actually worse than a hurricane, but I think I kind of drug my feet getting down there, if you know what I mean. But I put my family up against anybody. I brought that. I wanted to tell you the level of alcoholism that I came from. Okay? So I go down there. It's about 5 months later. I finally get down there. And when I get down there, so every time I come to visit my dad, because I'm prayed up when I go down there, and I was able to hug him. I remember when I was, you know, just, I told my sponsor when I was like 18 months old, I said, I want to hug my dad. And tell him I love him. I said, well, why don't you just go up to him, pretend you had a meeting, give him a hug and love him. And tell him that. So, you know, he's walking across the dam one day. I was like, Dad, come here. And he just woke up. I wasn't in my right mind. I gave him a hug and I told him that I love him, you know. And then so every time I fly home, he'd give me a hug and there'd be a tear would come out of his eye with joy. You know, that's how a relationship changed. 20 years. And, so this hurricane happened, so when I get there, he's coming to pick me up. They got 20 of my family members there, and they are all insane. And so, you know, I see my dad, you know, and I go up to him, and I go to give him a hug, and then this time, you know, saying that he's good to see me with a little tear jumping out, he loses it. He absolutely loses it, and he's like bawling, crying in my arms. And then so I'm holding him, patting on the back, saying, it's all right, Dad, it's just a house. All right, Dad, it's just a house. All my family members were looking at me like they were looking at friends and stuff. But, you know, so, I mean, and that was it, you know. So we went in and, you know, tried to get them, help them get reloaded and just work, you know, hard. And our family ended up getting back in for seven months. I got married on a Saturday. He got diagnosed with cancer on a Monday. I had left for 2 weeks to Honduras, and I called that Friday. I didn't know you went to the hospital. I called that Friday, and my little nephew was like, oh, you haven't heard? I said, no. He said, well, he got diagnosed with metastatic cancer. He's coming home on hospice. I'm like, okay. I hung up the phone. I cried for the next 5 days. I had to go get Gatorade because I was losing fluids. I couldn't stop crying. I don't know why they put me out in the middle of the Caribbean. You know, with $100 to use the phone, I'm so tight I ain't calling. And it was just, you know, I didn't want to call, but I didn't want him to see me in that shape. But I knew that was what that was for. And then I was gonna stay in New Orleans for three days. And I got to hang out with him. He ended up, I fly back on Tuesday, and he ended up dying. But what the deal is that I had a wonderful relationship with both my parents the last 20 years of both their lives. They absolutely loved me. And even though they wanted to kill me, you ask any one of my siblings, oh, you definitely was their favorite. You know, I mean, I'd have to pray for hours before I'd show up in their life. Hours. But I didn't want nothing. After I made amends, I didn't want nothing from him. I didn't care that he swept his car off with a broom before he got in. You know, it just didn't matter no more that he wore Chuck Taylors, you know, to Walmart. You know, that's the kind of shoes he liked to roll in. So, you know, it just didn't matter anymore, you know. So everything. So I got free from all of that. So I stick by AA because it's the best life I ever knew, never knew was possible. And here I am. I know John. He finally got me talk and do this, and when I came down here, I actually didn't even want to do it, but I hope y'all enjoyed it, and I'm here to carry a message that you can recover from alcoholism. Thank you.